invite the rest of the other members of the session to come forward and sit at the table up here for answering questions. So everybody can stay here if you want. We can bring up chairs. We don't make people stand. Okay. And Bruce will lead this session.
Well, thank you to all of our speakers. I hope that the rest of you share my feeling that these young professionals have brought us additional dimensions to expand some of the discussions which we have been having and to challenge us to look at, as of the last presentation, at least for me, alternatives by which we can address the issues of food insecurity. Things that I would say many of us, at least of my generation, would say looking at non-traditional foods. I think that we've heard four very interesting ideas. The first presentation, I think, allowed us to look beyond the discussion we've been having today about production and nutrition security, and we saw that in some cases they're not as well connected as we would like to think that they are. But that the need in that sequence of events to take into consideration the health effects, the eco-health work that is being done, would cause us to look at the fact that even foods that may be seen to be more nutritious could carry other risks to health and the well-being of the very people that are going to consume these foods. So I think this allows us to look in a richer way at what is the end result of this when we look at food security in terms of nutritional and family and individual well-being. I thought in the second presentation it was very interesting to be challenged to look at the concepts and the technologies which we have that can intensify food production and the issues of expansion, and to ask ourselves at least in what settings may these systems and approaches not be very sustainable, and that we need to return to discussions, or we need to think about as presented to us, that perhaps if we're looking at the need for more food to feed a growing population, we should start by saying, are we making the best use of the food that is already being produced? That the post-harvest loss discussion, which the International Development Research Center spent multi-million dollars of funding on in the 70s and 80s, seems to have got lost. And bringing that back to us with the benefits of new thinking and new technology perhaps can now put that back on the agenda and have us focus on ensuring that we're making sure that the foods that are being produced are put to best use. So I found that very encouraging. And in the spirit of other presentations, there are many things that maybe were ideas of the past for which we did not have the technologies to address and bring these forward, in particular in ways that might reach rural communities. We now have the benefit of technology to maybe put into practice the kinds of things which our speaker was bringing to our attention. I thought in our third presentation, we were exposed to needing to think more fully about how technology can be taken up by people. And I think the idea of lead, we heard about the lead women in the communities, the idea that people perhaps do not take up ideas just because they seem good when introduced by the extension worker. They take it up because of the networks that they are a part of and the confidence that they have in their local leaders who are encouraging this. That people learn by experience and they learn by following the example of people in whom they've had trust, that have shown leadership, and this builds confidence. And therefore the idea of social networking and looking at that as a way to improve capacity building and the uptake of new technologies, I think was very informative. And I was fascinated to listen to the presentation by the Aspire Food Group in other involvements that I personally have here in Canada, looking at social issues, the whole nature of social enterprise is rapidly replacing a lot of work that was donor-led and seen to be assisting people, but not in the same way that built in the sustainability that the social enterprise models are proposing. And also, of course, I'm sure we'll get interesting questions about their exposure to some of us, that there are alternative foods that we often do not think about. And in presentations both here and at many other conferences, when we talk about improving productivity, we're not talking about these food products because they are not often part of what's on the radar. On the other hand, it appears that, in fact, we're talking about intensifying foods that are quite common in many other social settings and in many other economic contexts. So I'm sure there's lots of room for questions. May I invite people to come to the microphones and bring forward their questions for our panelists. We'll do as before. We'll take about three questions, and then we'll continue with those who haven't gotten a chance to speak. We'll start with the young lady on this side.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm a PhD student at McGill in Plant Science. This is a question posed maybe towards all the presenters. I was wondering how traditional knowledge and traditional systems that are happening in the communities that you are working in, how they have influenced the interventions you have presented to us today, and how maybe they will influence the actual implementation of these innovations to make a change on the ground.
Thank you. A question from this side.
Thank you. Marie-Ève Castonguay again from the D of DFAT-D. Thank you very much for bringing up the question of waste. I was very happy to hear your thoughts on this particular matter. It's such a relevant question and quite pressing. In terms of a question for the Aspire project, I was wondering if you had considered in your work so far the potential resistance to introducing quality control in insect breeding, which is something very informal or grassroots in a sense. So have you had any kind of resistance in introducing that very important aspect if we want to consider scaling up? Thank you.
Thank you. And one more question from this side.
Hi, my name is Bernice, and I'm an undergrad in food science and nutrition. I actually saw you guys present at IFT in Chicago, and I'd like to congratulate you for winning the prize. My question is nutrition specific, and it's that with your initiative, do you expect to be simply fortifying do you expect just to be fortifying, or do you expect to be meeting the RDAs of the population, or would you go as far as reducing malnutrition, or would you say that it's too early to tell?
Okay, we'll come back to the other people that are standing in line in a moment. We're going to have answers to the first three, and then we'll return. Mm-hmm. So let me turn to the panelists and pick up the appropriate questions. Rachel was the first one directed your way.
Sure. Thank you. So with regard to indigenous technologies, traditional processes and methods, in my own experience in Panama, the program that I was working with, there were a number of different things that agriculture extension workers and nutritionists were trying to introduce in the communities. And some were more successful and some were less successful. And I suspect that success in rapid uptake of certain technologies had to do with prior familiarity with similar things. So introducing new food types, some were more successful than others because people just didn't know what to do with them. And I think this goes to Colleen's point as well, the importance of key individuals and communities who are willing to, champion is too strong a word, but who are willing to endorse certain technologies or new products that agriculture extension workers want to introduce, that there's a social component to that as well.
Did you want to add anything? Yeah, maybe I'll just add, there's a lot to say about traditional knowledge within
social networks, but maybe the one point that I will make is that social networks are also really important in transferring traditional knowledge back to the people doing the research and the extension, because the reality when you implement a technology on the ground is that it's not the same as the way you would implement it in a lab setting. Things get adjusted in accordance with traditional practices, traditional knowledge. And so understanding what works, what doesn't in a context-specific manner can really tap into these networks to feed that information back to the people developing these technologies.
Thank you. I know there were some questions to the Aspire group, and others may wish to comment to some of the questions that have been asked.
Okay, just to address the question, I think the traditional practices have been addressed to some degree. The resistance to quality control and breeding. I had the privilege of being on the ground in Ghana, Kenya, and Mexico and talking to farmers in those places about the possibility of farming insects. And universally, they were interested in economics. It was, can I make money doing this? If so, great, I'm a farmer, you know, I farm crops. There are drought issues. There are issues with crops dying, maybe, you know, maize lethal necrosis or other crop issues. And if this is something that people will buy, I will farm it. So the fact that it was a traditional source of food was great, but the exact method of preparation wasn't super important. And then the fortifying one. Do you want to take that one?
Sure. So when it comes to the degree to which we'll be fulfilling people's RDAs, it really depends on the area and the consumption and the choice. So we are going to be providing fortified foods, which people will be able to consume, and hopefully we'll be able to address some of their RDAs. There are a lot of areas, though, where consumption of seasonal insects hits a high enough level during the seasonal period where they're in season, they're accessible, that people are pretty much hitting their RDAs. A lot of people are close to hitting their RDAs when they're in season, and they disappear, and then for 9 months of the year, they're just not getting sufficient nutrition. So for some of those people, we expect we'll be able to, by providing lower cost year-round access to the food that they want to eat, we'll be able to eliminate malnutrition for some people. For other people, we'll just improve the situation.
On the questions that have come forward so far, does anyone else have any other comment you'd like to make before we field more questions?
About the traditional knowledge in terms of post-harvest, there is still more opportunity to spread awareness among the farming communities about how they could improve the post-harvest quality of the produce. And when I showed you the picture of the potato piles, that is a traditional structure that is utilized by farmers in Tamil Nadu. And the introduction of those ventilation pipes was able to tremendously increase the post-harvest shelf life of these produce. So a little modification to their traditional structures could go a long way in improving the quality of their produce.
I've just been reminded that there's another question, I think, to the Aspire group, which is about quality control.
Sure. So, sorry, maybe I didn't address that directly enough, but the quality control speaks to, for example, in Mexico right now, grasshoppers are often made in pots that have a lead paint glaze on them. It's just a traditional thing. These pots are seen as making them more delicious because lead is delicious. So that's something where, again, I think more, there won't be as much resistance, I don't think, to changing the nature of the process, so long as the product is close enough to what they're consuming now. That would be my intuition from what I saw on the ground.
Okay, thank you. Let us return to some questions.
Hi, my name is Jean-Claude Mubarak. I just joined the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. I'm a postdoc. Just came back for 2 years in Brazil. I don't want to insist on the on your group, but my question is a little specific. I was just wondering what goes on with the what are the type of processes that you're using when you take in the insect? Are the family using the insect? Are they using it with their meals in cooking methods, or is it come out as a snack product? So that's my question.
Okay, the question over this microphone.
Hi, my name is Furkan Asif. I'm a PhD candidate in international development at the University of Ottawa. Now, while I enjoyed all of your presentations, mine is specific to the Aspire group. My first question is a bit silly, but I know everyone is thinking it, is have you, so to speak, put your money where your mouth is and actually tried some of the insects? Because I'm wondering, I've tried some myself and they weren't too bad. Second is that while your focus was obviously in developing countries and addressing issues in slums and issues of food security, insecurity, my question is, what are your thoughts on that kind of a thinking in the so-called developed country context? And given how we focus a lot on meat, dairy, and it's very intensive practice, and it's causing a lot of issues that we know of in terms of environment and other ways, and also health. So what kind of implications are there for that model to be adopted in North America, Europe, etc.? Also, what are the obvious cultural barriers we'll have to overcome to have that as an acceptable source of protein to supplement the unsustainable practices that we have currently in the agri-food business? Thank you.
Thank you. And one thank more.
You. Thank you very much. I think he has touched on one of them, which is about behavior change, you know, getting people to consume what they probably haven't been consuming for a long time. But at the same time, I wanted to ask you, I understand that your focus is mainly on slums, but I'm just wondering, coming from Africa, there is a problem of locusts. Locusts are major menace, especially in West Africa, and I don't know whether you have really considered that as a potential area that you could also target, and not just targeting the slums, but also finding a way of coming up with value chains that will deliver even the commodities that you produce to the communities that are affected by some of these insects. Thank you.
Okay, let us just before you go, because right now there's only one more, so we'll take the one more question and then open it to the panelists.
For Shakila, I'll just pick up on the idea that you're talking about the need to actually have pasture-fed beef rather than grain-fed beef. And I think you actually hit on a very big issue because we have energy, food, and water, which is a kind of a trilemma facing the 21st century. And usually agriculture is very energy-intensive and water-intensive, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're using natural pasture, it usually is fed by the natural hydrological cycle rather than necessarily irrigated. And I think beef is usually something like 75,000 liters per kilogram of something like this. Is this something you actually looked into particularly? And do you actually have any further thoughts to make of it? And for the insect people, have you thought of asking Bill Clinton to have a nice Aboriginal sort of supper and dip a live scorpion in termite sauce and eat it, just to make it more popular here in the West?
Okay, I can see there's others that would like to speak, but we'll ask the panelists and then we'll have one more round. So it seems that Aspire is getting a number of questions, but some of them I do think overlap with other presentations, so I encourage other people to pick up on these questions where your research can add to the understanding. Please.
Great. So the first question, I think, was about processing and then how the foods are made available and what people do with the insects. So the processing is actually really light for most insects. It's just about boiling them in salt water, and then several things can be done. So some people, in certain markets, they would then be roasted. In certain markets, they would be provided to open-air markets, open-air stalls, where they would be lightly fried, grilled. And then some people will just either buy live insects or boiled insects at the market, take them home, and then do as they please with them. And then they do appear as part of meals. So kind of we've seen grasshoppers in a taco in Mexico. And then they're also used as a snack as well. And then we've also developed a few products. So one of them was our power flour. We also have something called a hop chip, which is like a masala-flavored cricket-fortified crisp. So it's baked, it's not fried. And it was traditionally made for the Kenyan market. And that would help to, again, like reach the RDAs and things like that to kind of develop these new ways to combat commercial foods that are making their ways into slums, like chips and chocolates and things, and at the same time increase iron and protein. In terms of the question of have we eaten insects, so I've probably eaten the widest variety of insects on the team, and they taste different. Some are salty, some are bitter, some are more sweet, and then some weren't so appealing to my palate, but I think there is an insect for everyone. And then I guess the other question was about developed countries and then sort of traditional practices. So we're only planning on going to markets where there is a desire to eat a specific insect already. We're not planning on introducing a new insect in a place where people don't already want it. We are definitely looking to expand the market. So in Kenya, for example, the Luhya tribe sees crickets as more of a traditional food. So we're hoping to bring that back and preserve that tradition. But for example, we wouldn't be going to India. We found that, that wouldn't work. An insect-based solution to food security probably wouldn't work there right now. And in terms of more developed countries, so in certain developed countries, especially in Europe, insects are a gourmet food. So we know of insect breeding companies that create insect-based snacks and sell them for a few euros for maybe 50 grams. In North America, there are a few American companies that are making like cricket-based granola bars or cricket-based snacks, and I think one of them has hit like $1 million in revenue just this past year. So we are seeing that it is starting to become more of a trend, and people are starting to become more open to this given the restrictions on our planet. And we definitely hope to be contributing to this worldwide shift in the way that we think about protein and in the way that we think about our diet and the impact on the environment. I don't know if any other contestants first have any opinions on any of that stuff.
I'll speak to the locust and using farming insects as a biological control. So locusts are certainly consumed in West Africa. There's a huge demand. In fact, it looks like the biggest insect consumption market in the world is in Nigeria, and they eat primarily locusts. There's huge amounts that are shipped in. They don't actually come in by themselves. They get caught primarily in Niger and a few other countries and then get imported into Nigeria. There's a huge import market, so it's more than we can satisfy. So if anyone else wants to get into that market, they're welcome to. Unfortunately, from a farming perspective, there's nothing we can do to reduce the influx of locusts from the Sahara. But when it comes to acting as biological controls, there are some things we can do. So, for example, there's an insect called palm weevil. And palm weevils are a huge pest in palm plantations, primarily oil palms. And oil palm plantations, when the trees reach maturity, they get torn down, and they usually get thrown in a pile or they get burnt. And if they're in a pile, that's a great breeding ground for palm weevils. Now, we can grab those piles. They'll give them to us for free in most part because they don't want them. We grind that up. We turn it into palm weevil food. We can make our own palm weevils. And the wild palm weevil population doesn't have these stockpiles of food that they can feed and breed in. So it actually should. We were talking with one of the world experts in palm weevil control, and he expects that if we do this, we'll actually control the wild palm weevil population and reduce predation on palm plantations while at the same time increasing providing a significant food source. And this is cool because we're not taking, say, grains like you would for cattle and redirecting them. So taking human food and redirecting it to insects, we're taking essentially garbage and not dirty garbage, but waste products and turning them into human food.
So my question was why I would recommend the use of pasture-fed beef as against grain-fed beef. The reason is that I found shocking statistics which show that we devote about 75% of our cultivable land for the production of animal feed, and it also covers pastures and grazing lands. And there is also statistics that tell us that 1 hectare of land could produce 11,500 loaves of bread as against 1,000 steaks. So I'm not saying that everybody should become vegans overnight. That's not possible, because it's true that the dairy industry and the poultry industry have some they add to the nutritional value and the revenue in some societies. But the thing is that even if we have small shifts in our diet, and if we could devote all the food crops to feed the human beings, because we have statistics that tell us that 35% of the food crops are devoted to animal feed production. So even if we have small shifts in our diets, like opting for pasture-fed beef, I think it would make a big difference in food security.
Thank you. Previously, there were other people heading for the mics. Does anyone want to head back, or? A secondary question.
In my old age, I actually forgot there was a second part to my whole question, because there is some evidence that suggests that a lot of desertification actually comes from the oxidization of plants, and they just kind of like sort of cover the land surface, and nothing actually kind of grows. And so if you actually have pasturing animals, they will actually eat that, plus the fact they are... This is quite nice, just before everyone has their cakes, urinate and defecate all over the land, which is actually good as a fertilizer. So in fact, it's actually better for the soil and combats desertification. Was this something also that kind of got factored in?
I agree that the domestication of animals has been a part and parcel of our agriculture. But my point is that if we convert highly productive croplands to grazing fields, no matter how efficiently, it would still result in a drain in the food supply, in the global food supply.
Okay. Let's take the three questions that are here.
Yeah, please. Claudia Ringler from IFPRI, just very directly on that livestock story, because it seems to go on. Basically, from a resource use efficiency perspective, it's much better to go for this intensified livestock production, maize-fed, etc., and don't send all those cows out and graze the rest of the land, because you would have to cut down the remaining forest. But not only that, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, livestock yield, livestock gain, etc. I mean, you just wouldn't get the same, basically. So it's good to take another look at that story. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is Dave Conley. I'm with the Aquaculture Communications Group. I was a speaker here in 2009. And I was the only one that talked about using the marine resources. Land is a finite thing, but we have 70% of this earth covered in water. And if we're really going to address this food security crisis, we have to start looking at the aquatic environments for raising food. If we look at feed conversion, beef cattle 10 to 1, salmon now down to almost 1 to 1. It's the most efficient feed conversion animal that we have. And the insect thing was really neat, because I wrote a proposal to develop an insect farming project for aquafeeds in 1995, and this was out of a project at UBC on Vancouver Island. So the idea of what you're doing is quite nice. I'd wished I'd won the $1 million back then, but I think that what you're really doing here, I like that you've got a lot of young people here, and I just wanted to wonder whether you are also looking beyond the land into the aquatic environment, because there is a lot of applications on what all of you have done in another realm.
Thank you. And a final question?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on the question, and I was not sure if I wanted to talk to you in private or share it, and I think it's important to share. What we're seeing today with in the world, the role of industrial food processing is that if you use processing to extend the duration of the food or make it more available, that's great, and that's what you guys are trying to do. The problem is when you use food processing to make a product that is sexy, desirable, attractive, ready to consume, this displaces the food that people are using in order to cook. So I think that the product that you're mentioning, going into a granola bar or chips, that won't be very different from the potato-based chips that we're seeing today. The problem is that people will start to snack more and eat less of the less attractive and sexy food. So I think it's a slippery road, and this wonderful project that you're having might become, or there's a danger that it's picked up to produce products that will be displacing that very healthy food that we have today. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments from the panelists?
I'll speak to the aquatic question. We're not looking at it directly right now, but you're right. The aquatic perspective, there's huge opportunity there, especially as we are running out of land. The thing primarily that we've explored for aquatics, and we haven't dug into it too deeply at the moment, but long-term is converting waste, either human waste or animal waste, into flies. You can convert them into flies quite comfortably, and then the flies make for a good food source. So there are a lot of areas where obviously there are issues with sanitation and removal of waste, and in those locations there's a distinct possibility we can convert that waste into flies and fly larvae and then feed that to fish.
Any other comments?
Just on the idea of making use of aquatic resources and alternate ideas like this insect idea, I think that what I was talking about really comes into effect here as well, because just to give an example, in the area that I work, although it's semi-arid and might seem bizarre that they would introduce fish farming, they did, and it actually worked out really well, because in some areas there's a clay-based soil and they get these big floods of rain, and if you can, for a relatively small labor cost, dig out a hole and start a fish farm, they can actually do really well. And the project wrapped up, and now the fish farms are all bare. Because, and also back to the question of traditional knowledge, this was not a community that had any exposure to these kinds of other things, and it was mentioned as well that there's certain areas where the insect thing would really take off and certain areas where it wouldn't, because of traditional practices, understanding of what constitutes food, how you prepare food. The people in this community just simply didn't know how to cook fish, weren't interested in eating fish, didn't like the taste. And so there certainly would need to be a lot of capacity building within the community to have a project like that become sustainable. And so these local existing knowledge networks would be incredibly valuable in that kind of capacity building project.
I just want to follow up on that. This fish farming is also something that has been tried in Panama. And one place where I saw it, it looked like it was going to be quite successful, is integration of large fish-raising ponds with the demonstration garden. So these are all located at the central school. People come once a week. They see what's going on. They have support from the Department of Agricultural Development. And then people were starting to adopt them at their own home. So there was support in terms of a little bit of technology, some knowledge, some starter breeder fish, but it looked quite promising.
So for the processing question, I think that it's largely dependent on what market we're dealing with. But for example, we're sort of more focused on an urban slum environment. And in our travels, we've found that when people are moving to the urban environment, they're seeking a more commercialized lifestyle. And so you have these instances where these products have already made their way into the little markets or the corner stores there. And those products are high fat, high carb. So you get potato chips and chocolate and all of that kind of thing. And so what we're looking to do is replace that sexy sort of food with something that's still sexy, but that is much more nutritious. But I'm not sure, what's the worst of all the evils, maybe? And then with the fortified flours, so for example, in Mexico City, the diet is heavily based on corn flour, and then by fortifying it, you're sort of adding a lot of protein and iron. It's our belief, and it's our sort of part of our value system, that we're not looking to change anybody's habits. And so you have these situations where parents want to please their kids, and their kids want these toys, and they can't afford them, but they can afford a chocolate bar or a chip or something like that. And so it's not our place to say that that's wrong, but just maybe provide a solution that is a little bit more nutritious, but that's still really fun, so that they can fulfill their desires.
Just before we thank the speakers, I would like to abuse the role of chair and say that in some ways I think a lot of what we've talked about at this conference so far presents us with many new options that we did not heretofore have, from science to ways of social organizing. We've heard about the importance of social networking. But in many ways, I think we have to consider that those people who most of the speakers are hoping will benefit from what is being known are people who live in situations where they cannot take risks. If we look at the history of intercropping in the Caribbean to help people move away from the dependence on bananas when the preferential trade agreements changed, people didn't often take up other things very early on because taking on a new crop or an intercrop was something that they have never experienced. And it meant that their limited family labor that might go to intercropping and might scientifically be very suitable in terms of the nutrient exchanges with the soil, people had to wait and find out whether it would work, because they couldn't take the chance that the extension workers' knowledge would work in their situation, given all the vagaries of the climatic conditions. And therefore, it reinforces what I thought was one of the many important points, which is you have to find, in some case, the lead farmer and provide them with some risk protection so that they can actually try new things. And it's the demonstration effect that allows others to take these things up. So I thought there were many interesting ideas, and that's not the one. I shouldn't pick one, but I do think that we have to bear in mind that the uptake of many of the new technologies has a lot, as much to do with risk as it does with access and credit and value chains. Can people take the risk of trying new things when their family labor, that is the basis of surviving tomorrow, is already highly occupied at the subsistence level? And while this conference we talk about wishing to have people move above as they wish to a subsistence level, we have to look at the risk factors and their ability to actually take on these new technologies. And I do believe that some of the new technologies and the need for us to also be very culturally understanding of the context. This entire discussion about the potential of the insect program with Aspire, I think, is very insightful, because if we look at many of the countries where there is not a resistance, as we have at least heard, to consumption of these high-protein insects, in some of them, their countries where the agribusiness industry has introduced crops that were not even traditional to those societies. And so in some ways, we're going back to say we have to start where people are coming from and build off of what is culturally acceptable to them, and not necessarily, as has been mentioned to us, expect that it's something that's going to be scalable into other cultural settings where there isn't this tradition. So I think that these young professionals are challenging us to look more holistically at the approaches that we are discussing, and I hope you'll join me in thanking them for their interventions.